So then, tell me about your time when you went to school. Was it directly after school then that you went?
No, I went to Trinity College, and I did what was then called Commerce, which is now probably has a fancy name like Business Studies or so, lots of other things. But you had to do an arts degree as well, and of course at that stage, just you had Trinity entrance, which you had to do Latin to get into Trinity, and I went into Trinity and got a BA and was a BCom. That was then, that would have been 1955, 56, I was finishing up, and most of my year we're talking about going away. Mm-hmm. But I decided I'd write around, wrote to Aer Lingus, wrote to Jacobs. And probably two things happened. One, because of my name, I was going to get an interview anyway, you know, out of courtesy to my father. But also, I hit it at a time they put an assistant internally into the personnel department, and he didn't like it, and he asked to be moved. And I went in, and I got wind of that, that there might be a base in there. Said I was interested in personnel work because I'd actually done as a subject personnel management in Trinity, and said I was told that I got the job on the basis of the answer to a question, because the then managing director, and this was a fairly grueling interview by the managing director and the assistant managing director. It was fairly high-level stuff for a junior position. Manager just said to me, well, how do you know you'd like personnel work? I said, well, I think I would. It was a very interesting subject. And he said to me, how would you like to come and work for us for nothing for 3 months to see if you like it? And I was, I suppose, quick enough to think, well, there's no right answer to this question. Because if you say yes, he'd say you don't think much of yourself. And you say no, he said you think an awful lot of yourself. So I said to him, well, I don't think 3 months would be long enough for me to make up my mind.
Very
and
good.
I was told afterwards I got the job on the basis of that answer. But I don't know whether that is not. So I went into the personnel department as the assistant in the men's personnel department, because at that stage was the men's personnel department and the women's welfare department, mm-hmm. that looked after of the men and the women separately, not necessarily even with the same policies, mm-hmm. and also had nothing to do with the so-called staff.
So, what was that like? I mean, you know, the early few years.
I went in 1957.
Yeah.
And at that stage, there were 2,000 people working in Bishop Street. And there were 500 men. And something like, there would have been 1,200 women and then 300 staff or something like that. But my job was purely with the men. By the time I left 16 years later, I knew every man in the place by name. And because that was it. But it was fascinating. It was big. It was a very different world to the one I'd been brought up in. And it was very hierarchical.
Yeah.
For example, the directors, who at that stage would have been all in some way or other descendants or related to the original Jacobs family or the Bewley family that went in at a later stage. There were two of the Bewleys there, and there was never Mr. Bewley, but it was Mr. Edward and Mr. Wilfred. At a level below that, you had managers and manageresses, and they were always Mr. or Miss. Except in one case was Mrs. because she was a widow. Otherwise, there were no married women in there. the lower level to that, you've got factory four men and four women who are always Mr. or Miss. And below that, it was either surname or Christian name, Smith or Joe or Mary or whatever it was. And that's the way it was. And once you were foreman or forewoman, you got your title. Once you were manager, you got your title. But in the Edward Bewley, who was the chairman at the time, used to refer to me always as Wiltshire, as if I was still at school. And that's the way it was, because when I think back on it, industry at that stage was very much organised on military systems, you know, in the way that it was managed through the almost the officers and the non-commissioned officers, and then the troops, and that's the way it worked. It was the same way.
So you were conscious of that, and
at the time I probably wasn't.
Yeah.
But I learned it fairly fast.
And there was pecking order, as you say.
Yes. And absolutely unknown at that time for anyone to be promoted from the factory floor onto the clerical staff or onto the management. Mm-hmm. Now, it changed while I was there. It changed while I was there.
But just before it changed, did it matter whether you were Catholic or Protestant, if you wanted to get up into the management?
Yes.
So what nomination?
There were very few Protestant managers. The clerical staff would have been majority Protestant as well. Very much so. Mm-hmm. Very much so. And in the craft areas, there were a very strong Protestant community right through it, you know, what I would call the craft class, the fitters, the carpenters, and the printers and people like that. There would have been a strong Protestant element in there.
Were you Catholic or Protestant?
Protestant.
So did that help your career in there, do you think?
I'd like to think it didn't. But I would imagine that if I had been Catholic, I wouldn't have been in there in the first place. I think it probably helped my acceptability amongst the other managers in there. One thing I know now that perhaps I didn't realise at the time, because I never got involved in it, there was probably right through the place a very strong Masonic influence.
Explain that to me. Members of the
Freemasons? Yeah.
Well,
and I would say that, my father was a member. I can think off the top of my head, six people that I know now were Freemasons that would have been in the management. Not that they talked about it at the time, but I just know. Mm-hmm. Somebody did make an approach to me once to say, would you not come down to Mortimer Street sometime, which I didn't want to do anyway. But there was probably quite a strong Masonic influence in there.
Yeah. And the Quaker tradition as well, of course.
The Quaker tradition was dying out there then, because whereas the Jacobs were Quakers originally, the descendants tended to move away more perhaps into the Church of Ireland. There was one Quaker there, Brian Pym, who was a great-great-grandson of the Jacobs, and his mother was a Jacob who married into the Pym family of Mount Melick, the Quaker family. I think Brian Pym's still alive. Mm-hmm. And certainly his children are still alive. And the person in the department actually at that stage had quite a lot of power. which I thought was normal until I went to work in other companies and realized how wrong it was. Because what had happened was there was a personnel manager there who was retired before I went there, who had been a very strong personality, and management had been quite happy to abdicate some of their responsibilities to him. For example, work started at 8 o'clock in the morning. The door was closed at 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
It wasn't opened until 9, and if people arrived late in the factory, they lost an hour's pay.
My goodness, yeah. Now, yeah.
If they had a reasonable excuse, they could be let in. And it was me who had the decision, because I was the one who came in at 8 o'clock in the personnel department. Never mind the poor manager who was waiting on a man to start his machine.
Yeah.
He couldn't decide it. It was me who had the decision in the personnel department as to whether this person would be let in or not, depending on his own excuse, because we kept the late-keeping records, and we were able to look up and say, no, you were late 3 times last week, we knew the offenders. But really, this should have been being done by the managers themselves. And we also decided where people went to work within the factory. Because as there would be variations in production, if a machine went down, there might be maybe 4 or 5 people for whom there wasn't work that day. And it was the personnel department's job to say where they went, because we ran the cleaning staff. And if nobody else wanted them, they ended up on the cleaning staff cleaning windows, which they hated. So we had a lot of power like that that should have been in the hands of the actual managers.
And so with the being in charge of personnel and were you handling unions, or were you connected with unions?
Yes, there was the union negotiations were done through our office, and there was the Workers' Union of Ireland and the Amalgamated Transport and General Workers' Union were there, and 14 other unions, including 2 for the boilermen, the 3 boilermen. One man was in one union and the other 2 were in another, and the one man in his union called a strike once by standing in the middle of the boiler room and saying, I'm calling a meeting of whatever it is, union, yeah, putting it to that because of our unsolved grievances we're serving strike notice. And he went out a one-man picket.
It was that easy. It was that easy to do that. Yeah. And so, I mean, looking back at it now, could you tell me, I mean, those days, were they, you know, was there a sense of just the unions had that huge power with companies. It almost, you know, in many cases, it damaged them, you know. Would you agree with me on that?
I don't think they had that power in Jacobs until the second strike in the 1960s. I say the second strike because the first one was in 1913, was called. And there was a strike then that caught everybody by surprise in the 1960s, because what happened was there was a wages demand, wasn't met, strike notice served, everybody thought it was going to be fixed. It wasn't, and all of a sudden they found themselves on a Friday that the strike was starting on Monday and nobody was ready for it. Nobody was ready for it. And the people didn't know what they were at. I mean, I arrived down on my bicycle and the picket was sort of standing outside on Monday morning and didn't know what to do. And good morning, how are you? Well, yeah, well, actually we'll get it fixed, right? And they sort of said, well, we'd better walk up and down a bit, which they did. And then at 10 o'clock they said it's break time and they went into the canteen. So that was caught everybody by surprise, that one. Because nobody expected, because you see, a strike in Jacobs was ferociously expensive for a union because there were so many people.
Yeah. And so, did that last long?
A week. A week. A week, yeah. I thought it was fixed in a week. weeks in a week, and it probably, as I said, caught everybody's surprise,
yeah.
And shouldn't have happened, and people were bluffing and got that bluff called. Now, there was very little ill feeling over it. Very little.
Yeah.
Very little.
And, you know, kind of, I suppose, were people happy there? You know, were they, if for example, I'm sure a lot of people would have come up to you if they had a problem and they discuss it with you.
It was a good job. Whereas the pay was normal, you know, for the industry. The conditions were good. And there were quite a lot of perks with it for people.
Yeah.
They had a pension scheme. I mean, when I went to Jacobson, they had over 400 pensioners.
Yeah.
It was unheard of at the time. And there was a good pension scheme in there. They had medical access for doctor, dentist.
Mm.
And they had also a lot of recreational activities. I mean, there was the football club. They had a football ground in Dolphins Bar, and it's another one that's owned by the Irish Transport and General Workers Union. They had a recreation hall where they had physical training classes. The staff had badminton, and the workers had badminton. That's right. They had dances, and they had put on concerts. So there was a lot going on that was there, and there was good, I would call, welfare backup for people if they got into difficulty. And if they came and asked for help, it was there. There was still quite a lot of the Quaker ethos when I went there, of looking after people. Now, in return, they expected loyalty. You know, I'm not, and you did what you were told. But that was the other side of it.
Now, you're taking me into the 60s, and that was a time, you know, when we weren't yet part of the common market. We were things were good. We seemed to be doing very well here.
Well, what happened was Jacobs, through the war, through the emergency, and through the economic sanctions afterwards, had a protected industry. Because there was no, in the 50s, in the early 50s, from the end of the war, there were very few English biscuits came in here, because there was a very high tariff on them. In the early 50s, Boland's, the bakers, started up a biscuit factory in Dean's Grange. And that was the first time Jacobs had hit competition for a long time. So yes, things were good. Jacobs were fairly modern. They put a lot of capital investment into new ovens, and also they were able to cope with the change in the retail trade, which was moving from loose biscuits and tins into packet biscuits, because I can remember Jacobs producing, and it would have been about 58, 59, they put out wrapped cream crackers.
Yeah.
Using machines that they had used in the 1930s.
And they were still going.
Were still going, they were very slow. But they had it there, and they had the expertise to be able to do it. And then that slowly expanded into putting a lot more things in packets. And moving away from the tins and the packing of tins, which was very labour intensive anyway.
Yeah.